Title for today's sermon is, Does the Earth Need Us? The answer is no. But before we sing our closing hymn, let me just add a little bit to that. Truth to tell, this has to be one of the more, sermon titles I've ever dreamed up. We're living on a planet, after all, that got along perfectly well for some 4 to 5 billion years, depending upon who's counting, without a single human being on it anywhere, and needing nothing at all, other than certain natural and cosmic laws remaining in effect in order to keep itself going. It took the late-breaking arrival of a supposedly intelligent species before the question that makes up this sermon title of mine could even be raised. And therein lies the rub. Because while the Earth-centered response to the question I'm posing is, I would think, an obvious no, our human-centered answer, particularly in the Western world, has actually been yes. I'm going to come back to this point in a little more detail later, only noting now that practically all of Western religions, nearly all Western schools of philosophy, for all the differences that exist within and among them, they practically all assume the centrality of human beings on our planet. And there's another duh for you. Of course they're going to assume the centrality of human beings, since nearly all earthly religions and philosophies and worldviews, after all, are products of the human mind. Well, we'll keep that one on the shelf for a little while also. So I can do one of my classic, let's back up and see where we're going with all of this maneuvers. Last winter, we as a congregation embarked upon our participation in what our Unitarian Universalist Association has called the Green Sanctuary or Ministry for the Earth program. So we formed ourselves a Green Sanctuary Task Force to carry that program forward. And in a way that really parallels what's going on right now, we're not the only ones doing this, it really parallels what's going on in a very wide range of religious denominations and communions. Our association urges member congregations to undertake programs of study and action and advocacy that will promote greater levels of ecological awareness and practices, both within our Unitarian Universalist congregations and the communities in which they're located, and on out beyond that to the world in which we all live. And we've been trying, with a very good success, I would say, to hold up our end of things on the local level here in Nashua, thanks to this task force I just mentioned. Lori already made the announcement earlier that we're coming up, on the halfway point on our Food for Thought Thursday series for Ministry for the Earth. As she noted, the theme for this week is supporting locally and ethically produced food in the greater Nashua area. There's two more sessions to go after that. I urge you to attend them as you are able. Well, I see my role in this very worthy effort as being at least a twofold one. I want to support the work of our task force in whatever ways I can, as I hope each of you will. And I'm going to weigh in from time to time up here with a Green Sanctuary sermon, which is what you're getting this morning. I've come to see that one of my roles as a minister here is to try to be, the big picture guy. I know I need to be attending to any number of details in any number of areas of our church life, but I also like to, and I think I need to be able to step back now and then and say why, in the biggest and broadest and hopefully the best sense of the term, we do the things we do around here. And sometimes that why that I attempt to speak to goes to the cosmic level, which is what I'll finally be aiming for this morning. Okay, well, I try to avoid doing the sermon as book report approach as much as I can, but I still want to use one of my more fascinating summer readings as a jumping off point for us today. The book, maybe some of you see it, it's by Alan Weissman, and it's called The World Without Us, which was published a little earlier this year. And in it, Mr. Weissman uses a very fanciful, even fantastic premise to play out some very factual and scientifically based scenarios. He's an award-winning journalist, and the book that he wrote is an outgrowth of an article that he published back in 2005 for Discover Magazine titled Earth Without People. Now, this is not one of those doomsday, we're all going to die if we don't shape up kinds of books. It rather assumes that we've already gone, without specifically saying how. Maybe we all just got mass evacuated to another planet. Weissman doesn't say. But I'm going to give you the book's basic framework. I'm going to read a little bit from its opening chapter. Let's try a creative experiment. Suppose that the worst has happened. Human extinction is a fiat accompli. Not by nuclear calamity, asteroid collision, or anything ruinous enough to wipe out everything else, nor by some grim eco-scenario in which we agonizingly fade. Instead, picture a world from which we all suddenly vanish. Tomorrow. Leave it all in place, but extract the human beings. How long would it take to recover lost ground and restore Eden to the way it must have gleamed and smelled the day before Adam or Homo habilis appeared? How would it undo our monumental cities and public works and reduce our myriad plastics and toxic synthetics back to benign basic elements? Or are some so unnatural they're indestructible? And what of our finest creations? Our architecture, our art, our many manifestations of the spirit. Are they truly timeless? At least enough to last until the sun expands and roasts our earth to a cinder? And even after that, might we have left some faint, enduring mark on the universe, some lasting glow or echo of earthly humanity? Well, the only thing I've ever heard of that would cause such a situation as instant human disappearance is this event called the Rapture. And I'm not going near that one. And neither does Weissman. The rest of the book, in fact, is him playing out this scenario that I just read here that he poses. And in doing so, he draws very heavily on his knowledge of science and engineering. Get the impression that he actually acknowledges this. He must have interviewed and researched all kinds of the works of all kinds of scientists and engineers, since that's what he's primarily relying upon to write this thing. The book even has a bit of a science fiction kind of a flavor to it. And in the interest of time, I can only offer a few brief examples of all the places he goes and suggest you read the book if you want to get the whole kit and caboodle. But for today, just try these on for size. In New York City, there's enough water. I didn't know this all the years I visited New York. There's enough water constantly flowing underground that pumps have to be in constant operation just to keep the subways from flooding. If these pumps stopped running for 2 days, the subways would flood. Left untended for about 20 years, the water would work its way up through the pavement to the surface, cause all the other buildings to collapse, and Lexington Avenue would become a river. You know, like you have the East River on one side, the Hudson on the other side, you have this other river going right down the middle. With no one to tend them, the world's 400 nuclear power plants would melt down rather quickly. And our petrochemical plants, again left untended, would soon start throwing out all kinds of toxins for many years to come, all of which could take out a few species here and there. But not to worry, since the Earth still has some 4 to 5 billion years left before our sun expands into a red star and burns up all the inner planets, it would just eventually clean up all of our messes and leave our leaves pretty much to go back the way it was before we human types ever came along. I say pretty much, because Weissman points out that there are certain things around, like non-biodegradable plastic bottles and bags and Q-tip shafts that are basically indestructible over any length of time. I thought about that, went to my bathroom, got one of these things, and I thought, imagine that. These little things we use to clean out our ears, we can't get rid of them. They're going to last as long as the Earth is here. Well, Weissman fancifully wonders also what subsequent species who might attain something approaching our level of human awareness and capacity for perception, he wonders what such a species would make of Mount Rushmore, because it would still be up there, And he notes that the Abraham Lincoln, who is carved in granite, would last much longer than the Lincoln on our copper pennies. And on he goes like this, throughout this whole book. Every now and then, he takes the reader to a few isolated spots on the planet where the Earth has retained much of its primeval character to kind of give us some idea of where the Earth would be going or going back to once it gets us out of the way. Well, it's an interesting book. It's well researched and written. It is a good read. But you come away wondering, I come away wondering, well, all right, what's the point here? For Weissman treads very lightly. He kind of touches on it now and then, but he actually treads very lightly when it comes to offering any kind of philosophical, religious, or spiritual reflection on all this data that he keeps putting out there. In fact, I guess he decided he was going to leave that part to his readers, which is what I'm going to take up now. Because the first thing I came away with upon reading this book was a sense, or a renewed sense, really, of how tenuous for all of the many and sometimes vast human civilizations we have a record, how tenuous our grip on this planet actually is, and the rather fragile ways in which we actually cling to it. And the second and closely related conclusion I came to was how foolish we human beings have been to place ourselves, as we often have, at the center or at the apex of creation. For while our common sense tells us, going back to where I started this sermon today, our common sense tells us, well, no, the Earth doesn't need us to be here. But we still act and believe as if the Earth were somehow waiting around for us to show up to give it some reason for being here. Think a minute about the fundamental creation story that lies at the heart of the Judaic and Christian traditions, and by extension, whether people find themselves in that tradition or not, by extension, the basic mindset of Western civilization. You see, it doesn't matter whether you read the creation story on a literal or mythical or metaphorical or allegorical level. None of that matters for what I'm trying to say this morning, because we all live out and we all participate in the implications of that story, regardless of whatever level we read it on. As I say, it doesn't matter whether you're a believer or a non-believer on this one, when it comes to the religions that have told this story over the past millennia. Think about it. The Creator starts out with the heavens and the earth, then moves to water, then to plants, then to animals. Finally, blare of trumpets, roll of drums, brings on the first human beings. The whole creative process, in other words, is kind of treated as a prelude or as an opening act for the grand entry of the first humans. And those humans are told they had to have dominion over the earth. They're told they can name all the other animals. Now, within the original context of when this story was first told and then later written, within the culture it was first told and written, to give something a name is to give it purpose and give it meaning in a way that it did not previously have. So we have been living out the implications of this story. And in so doing, living that implication has given us some great and wonderful civilizations. It has given us some amazing human creativity in the areas of science and the arts. It's given us an earthly home that we have been largely able to shape to our likings. But it's also brought out the destructive side of our humanity in ways that have greatly despoiled our earthly home, and has left open the question of whether or not it will continue, this home of ours, to sustain us and nurture us if we keep treating it in the manner that we do. So in addition to all the necessary and, yes, crucial measures we need to be taking to live in a more ecologically responsible and eco-friendly way, and as I've said earlier, our Green Sanctuary program is one of the ways we're exploring these kinds of practices, trying to educate ourselves a little bit better to them. Beyond all of that, we also need to to re-envision, whatever ways we can, our whole relationship to and with this planet, for which we are very latecomers. We need to learn what it means to be a part, one part, of a larger circle of life, and not the masters of the circle. It's what our seventh Unitarian Universalist principle calls respect for the interdependent web of creation, which we're all a part of. What does it mean to live in that web rather than be masters of the web? For thinking we are masters is really something of a delusion. Most of all, I think we need images that will help us to re-envision and redefine what our true relationship to the rest of creation really is and needs to be. And I'm glad to say, optimist that I try to be, that some of these new images are being given to us. And what I'd like to offer as I move towards a conclusion here is courtesy of the late scientist and the astronomer, Dr. Carl Sagan. It's the image of the pale blue dot. I don't believe he's here this morning, but I want to thank Stephen Noddin for introducing me to the words I'm going to share of Dr. Sagan's in just a moment. He read them as a chalice lighting at our last executive board meeting. In February of 1990, as the Voyager 1 spacecraft was making its way out of our solar system, the NASA engineers had it turned around so it could take a picture of the planets as it headed on out into deeper space. And one of the pictures it took, of course, was of the Earth from nearly 4 billion miles out. Now, I can just barely see the picture here. You can pull this off the web if you go just the pale blue dot. This will come up. I can just barely see this here, which means you can't see it where you are at all, but there's this little tiny blue dot along this white line that is the Earth. And Sagan used this image, pale blue dot, as a title for a book he wrote in the aftermath of the Voyager mission. He also used it as a theme for a commencement address he delivered in May of 1996. As it turned out, Dr. Sagan died just 8 months after giving this address. So what he had to say about the meaning of the photograph is something he said in what proved to be one of his last public appearances. I'll read this. If you look at this picture, you see a dot. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you know, everyone you love, everyone you've ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of all our joys and sufferings, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilizations, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every hopeful child, every mother and father, every inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species live there. On a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of the dot on scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner of the dot. How frequent their misunderstandings. How eager they are to kill one another. How fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged place in the universe are challenged by this pale point of light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the vast and the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. It's up to us. To my mind, there is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionately with one another, and to preserve and cherish this pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. These are very good words, very good thoughts indeed, troubling in places, but very well stated. And the ones I want to especially hold up for us this morning are where Dr. Sagan says, our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion, my emphasis added, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. It underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionately with one another, and to preserve and cherish this pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. If we can, in fact, move beyond what Sagan rightly calls the delusion that we have a privileged position in the universe, and in our world as part of that universe, then perhaps we will truly seek and find ways to deal more compassionately with one another, as well as preserve and cherish this only home we have and have ever known. So I'll end with this. On the brochure that describes our Green Sanctuary program currently going on, there's some words on that brochure that says what the program is about. Reads, a Green Sanctuary is a congregation that lives out its commitment to the earth by creating a sustainable lifestyle for its members as individuals and as a faith community. That's what we're trying to do within this congregation and in our wider natural community. It's an undertaking we should each and all commit our energies to. And I'd like to suggest that as we carry this program forward, we take the very term Green Sanctuary, take it to another level. I guess I'm kind of mixing up my color metaphors a little bit here. But how about we think of Carl Sagan's pale blue dot as a green sanctuary all of its own? We need to regard the earth as a green sanctuary. A sanctuary is a sacred and holy place and is to be treated as such. A sanctuary is where one goes for sustenance and nurture and renewal. And we need to care for the earth so it can be such a sanctuary for us. For in the end, as Mr. Weissman does correctly point out, in the midst of all his fantasizing, the earth will make of itself a green sanctuary, whether we choose to inhabit it or not. Let's sing together our closing hymn.